Here we go.
Welcome to BP WrigleyCast, the show where everything's made up and the points don't count. My name is Ryan Davis, sitting in for Carlos Porter Carrero, who had a surprise pottery class tonight with Isaac Bennett and Joel C. Reese. How are you guys doing?
Good. And I'd just like to clarify that Carlos's pottery class is not with me, which it sort of sounded like it was there. But no, I'm here talking about baseball like I should be.
That's too bad. I know you invited him to your pottery class, and he declined the invitation, so I'm sorry about that. I feel bad.
We love Carlos, but we also love to make fun of him, so we're glad he's not here.
Yeah. Well, at least Fight Club didn't get in the way this week.
He's a man of many talents.
Yes. And with that, now that we've made fun of Carlos in an appropriate amount of time, let's get into talking about the Cubs. Just to recap real quick, last week we sat here and discussed how the Cubs were in kind of a slump, and they had lost a bunch of games. I want to say, like, you know, they had won four of their last 12, something like that. So sitting as of right now, Cubs have won five games in a row, three-game sweep against the Phillies at home, plus the last two games against the Cardinals in St. Louis. They're now 6.5 games up on Pittsburgh, 9.5 games up on the Cardinals. How are you guys feeling about the Cubs right now versus how you felt last week? Isaac?
I feel about the same, to be honest. We talked about it, I think, towards the end of that. But in that streak where they went 4-8, they actually outscored their opponents by 4 runs. So it was far more likely that they would have gone maybe 6-6 or 7-5 during that time. They lost 3 or 4 one-run games, and a couple of the other 8 losses were close as well. So fundamentally, I don't really feel any different than I did before. But I will say that seeing that NL Central lead shrink to 4.5 games over the Pirates was a little disconcerting, and it was closer than I was really hoping it would ever get. So these last 2 days to separate it back to 6.5 really feels like they took advantage of a weekend against a weaker team and did what they needed to do. So I guess I feel a little more comfortable, but I feel almost exactly the same about the team itself.
So you said weaker team, so you don't buy the Phillies?
No, I don't. Not yet. It's impressive what they've done, and I'm in some ways I'm happy for them, but I don't really buy them.
Okay. Joel, what about you?
Well, I mean, I know that, you know, numerically, like Isaac said, that you know, bad stretch they had was not truly bad. It was just kind of, you know, baseball happening, and the numbers didn't quite go their way. But, you know, being human, it did bum me out a little bit, and I was, you know, I was kind of gnashing my teeth. And it was just, it's just so encouraging to see. And I know that, you know, this is, it's an up and down season. We should try to maintain, but it's just so gratifying to see them, you know, Lackey pitch well, Kyle Hendricks go crazy, you know, yesterday, Ben Zobrist, you know, hitting out of his mind, Miguel Montero hitting homers, and it's just, it feels like, you know, and I know that we can sit there and discuss the bad streak and say, well, you know, this is just regression, and we understand this, and clearly on before they were like, what, on schedule when on pace win 125 games, so that was not sustainable. So there was bound to be some regression, but it just feels so good. I just on a human level, it feels so good to see them do this, and it kind of makes me feel like they're almost, I don't quite know how to put this. They're almost it's impossible for them to go on a big-time losing streak because someone is going to come through. If it's Montero, if it's not Montero, it's Zobrist. If it's not Zobrist, it's Fowler. If it's not Fowler, it's Hayward starting to go the other way. You know, I feel like there's so much talent. It's all going to – someone is going to pick up. You know, and Rizzo is obviously scuffling. Addison Russell – no offense, Isaac. Addison Russell he's been struggling. Matt Caesar is, you know – clearly he's only around because – you know, he's a platoon player, but he hasn't been doing a lot. Soler's been coming back, but, you know, it just feels like someone is going to pick it up if the team is struggling, and it's just really encouraging to see that.
The other point is that old saying that momentum is your next day's starting pitcher, and I really believe that teams will, if there is momentum day to day, it's just hitters not slumping, all feeling good with their timing at the plate, and then a really good starting pitcher on the mound. The Cubs against the Phillies this week, their starting pitchers 22 and a third innings, 3 earned runs combined. One of those earned runs was that garbage run the Phillies scored in the ninth inning off Hendricks that didn't matter at all. And then, again, one of those runs again, I think in the sixth or seventh inning off Lackey today, when the Cubs were already up 7-0 and it didn't matter one bit. It was, I think, a wind-aided home run. So that tells you a lot about their starting pitching stepping up. On the flip side of it, though, the Phillies are 14th in the National League in runs scored. So if they were to run up against a team with a very good offense, this whole thing could look really different. What do you guys think? Are the Cubs really coming out of it, or are they just, running against a team that, can't hold their own against the Cubs?
Well, a couple of thoughts. You asked me about the Phillies earlier, and the main reason I would point to not really believing in their early season record, which was pretty good. I think there's still two games over 500, but they have a run differential of negative 43 runs, which is actually the third worst in the National League. So you just can't sustain a winning record when you're really losing from a run differential standpoint. You can't do that over a whole season. But as far as your question about the whether or not the Cubs are actually breaking back out, yeah, I think so. I'd have to go back and look at the numbers, but I don't think that there is a six-game stretch this year where they've actually had a losing run differential. I was trying to piece that together earlier, and I didn't get quite all the way through it, but which means that the consistency of what they've done has been incredibly impressive. And you mentioned that the next day starting pitcher. I was working on a piece today for the Wrigleyville site that was looking at all the National League's fifth starters, and let me tell you, the fifth starters in the National League are a wasteland. Beyond Joe Ross, Kyle Hendricks, and Bartolo Colon, it is just rough. There are so many teams, even contending teams, that don't have a legitimate fifth starter. And that's Hendricks. And Hendricks has an ERA under 3. He has a WHIP under 1. He's one of 3 Cubs starters in the top 8 in baseball and WHIP, along with Lackey and Arrieta, which leaves Jason Hamill and John Lester, who have both been borderline dominant this year, as not in the top 8. So it's just been incredibly impressive. And I think if you went top to bottom and compared our 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 versus just about any other team in the league, it would look really, really favorable. And that's slump-proof. That's what that is. As long as those 5 stay healthy, it's going to be very hard to get this team on more than a 2 or 3 game losing streak at a time. So I do think that they are breaking back out, if you want to call it that. But in general, I just think they're incredibly solid and very deep, and their pitching is very deep. And that's why you see a team that just can rattle off 5 in a row like it's nothing. And, you get into a 3-game losing streak and it feels like the end of the world, but then it's 5 straight wins and, the world is right again.
Well, and Joel, I'll direct this to you because you've talked very glowingly about Kyle Hendricks, and I think he went to Dartmouth.
I didn't know that.
How are you feeling about the Cubs rotation as of right now? Granted, everything we just said about the Phillies, I think Lackey has the highest ERA and it's in the low 3s, and Hendricks is below 3 with all the stuff Isaac just said. Do you feel like the Cubs still need to go out and trade for a starter, or are you fine with letting it roll as it is?
I mean, I think I said this last week, I'm pretty much okay with them going to bat in the playoffs. I mean, it's funny that we're, this is May and we're saying, well, in the playoffs, in June we're going to be talking about how to set up the rest of the schedule to, maximize their playoff rotation. But I feel like, Hendricks obviously and Hamill didn't kill it in the playoffs last year, but they've got a little more experience, and I'm fine with them. And if you say, what do they need right now? I would say, I don't know, maybe a lefty out of the bullpen, a shutdown lefty. Otherwise, I don't know. I feel like I'm pretty good with them with this rotation going forward. I know there's been talk about Sonny Gray and, different studs, the guy on the Rays, Odorizzi. But I mean, I'm okay. I feel like I want them to go for it this year. Like, and we've talked about this before. Like, I wouldn't give up Contreras. I wouldn't give up, I don't know, Dylan Cease. Again, we've talked about this before, so I don't want to retread the same ground. But there's very few players I wouldn't give up because I want them to go for it now. But on the same, on the other side, I don't know what you would go for. Like, what would you need to trade for? Like, I just don't see it. So I don't know. Isaac, what do you think they should – like, do you see any weaknesses? Like, I just don't.
Well, it's 2 months to the trade deadline, and I think that's the biggest thing. So health plays a huge role here. But as far as a weakness, my whole piece actually today was structured around the perspective that we have of Kyle Hendricks and why I think psychologically he's undervalued, because scouting reports told us for years that he wasn't going to be a major league starter, and then they told us he wasn't going to be a good one. Then they, you know, they told us, okay, he can be a fifth starter or whatever else. But so I think we're sort of psychologically patterned to believing he's not as good as he actually is. The results are there, and they've been there now for, you know, a year and a half. So the weakness is in the fickleness of the fickle nature of baseball. And I think the Cubs could get into a scenario where they don't go trade for a starting pitcher and then regret it when Hamill either regresses hardcore or gets hurt, or maybe Hendricks, you know, wears down towards the end of the year as his inning counts come up. So it's really tough to make that call sitting here in May, and thankfully they don't have to. But the one thing that I would say is that I will be very surprised if they do not go out and get a shutdown lefty. A McGee, yeah, or an Andrew Miller, an Aroldis Chapman, somebody that's really, really dominant against left-handers. I think that's the one obvious point, with Travis Wood struggling a little bit and Clayton Richard looks terrible. So I think that's the one area where we're going to see them address something maybe sooner rather than later, pretty much as soon as somebody's willing to deal one. So I think they'll reach into their prospect depth and deal for a lefty out of the bullpen. And the only way I think we'll see a high-profile starting pitching trade is if somebody goes down to injury or shows serious ineffectiveness before now. Because frankly, right now, you can't put Sonny Gray in this rotation, I don't think. He is struggling too bad, and you can't, sure, bump out one of the guys. You can't bump out Hamill or Hendricks for a guy that's, right, simply, yeah, not getting hitters out.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point, Isaac. And another thing to think about, just on a numbers level, that's true. And also, I think that they've worked so hard, and Madden has done such a great job of kind of creating this really amazing team, this camaraderie. And to bring someone in from the outside and be like, well, we're going to, you know, slot you in as our number three guy because you've got the name and you've done this in the past, I think that would – I mean, I don't think they're so fragile that they would just fall apart like, you know, the White Sox have for whatever reason. But I think that that would just – I think that they're too strong of a team. And I don't think that the front office is the type to do anything reactionary like that, you know, just go for a guy because they feel like maybe they should. I mean, if the rotation is doing well, I don't see them making a move to, you know, supplant anyone because they don't need to.
Well, here's my question. Throwing out the idea that maybe, you know, Hendricks might wear down at the end of the year, or that Hamill will have, you know, second half Hamill problems. If they're going into the playoffs with this rotation, game one is Arrieta in an ideal world, two is Lester, three is Lackey. You're not going to do much better than one, two, three. Game four, you're kind of hoping that either one of Hamill or Hendricks will be able to, you know, go out there and give you a game. But, you know, Hamill was bad last year down the stretch and in the playoffs. Hendricks, in his first game in the playoffs, he made just a handful of mistakes. The Cardinals hit three solo home runs off of him, but otherwise he was doing just fine. And Madden pulled him early from that game, because he gave up a solo, I want to say one solo home run in the fifth inning with two outs. So he ended up 4 2/3 innings with 3 earned runs, which looks bad, but I was at that game. He pitched very well for the majority of the game. He was getting weak contact, and I want to say 4 2/3 with like 9 strikeouts. So I don't feel necessarily terrible about Kyle Hendricks in the playoffs. And then again, against the Mets, I want to say it was 4 innings, 2 earned runs. It wasn't bad. It's just Madden at that point didn't have the trust to let him go any further than probably the fifth inning. So far this year, it looks like that trust is back. He pitched 9 innings yesterday. So I don't think we should be too reactionary to say that Kyle Hendricks can't pitch in the playoffs. I've had people say that to me on Twitter. Even after yesterday's game, the biggest compliment somebody would give was Kyle Hendricks is an established regular season pitcher. And my point to that was, so is Jake Arrieta an established regular season pitcher? Are you saying he can't pitch in the postseason because, you know, in two of his three starts, he didn't pitch all that great? Or what about Clayton Kershaw with his 4.5 ERA in the playoffs? The point is, I don't think it is a different game in the playoffs, but I don't think we should just label guys and say, you know, oh, Kyle Hendricks, you know, for whatever reason, can't pitch in the playoffs.
Yeah, and it's sort of the old here blind stat line A and blind stat line B, because you're going to be hard pressed to find 60 to 75 pitchers in the major leagues that are better than Jason Hamill and Kyle Hendricks right now, and maybe in general. They were both there last year, so you're talking about a three, you know, on most teams for both of these guys. And I think that's justified. I try really hard not to throw out arbitrary numbers, but I think that's justified. And you take their names off, and it's maybe not sexy, but they're both effective starters right now. And I think you made a really good point about Hendricks last year against the Cardinals. He was pitching well in that game. And the Kyle Hendricks we're seeing this year is better than the Kyle Hendricks that we saw last year. You know, he was good enough to start last year, and I think he's even better now. He's aging very beautifully, very gracefully, and I think that he's going to do nothing but get better and better as long as he doesn't get tired. So I just don't see it right now. I think that their pitching staff is the best in the National League with respect to the Nationals and the Mets, but it's right there with both of those teams or maybe better. And, I mean, their offense is quite a bit better. So it would be very hard for me to see a trade that actually kicked one of those guys out of the rotation right now. It would turn my stomach a little bit.
Whoa.
Yeah, and more to that point, I think people lose sight of the fact that the rotation is going to change a bit in the next 2 years. And we could argue all day about whether Jake Arrieta is going to be back after next season or not. But just simple facts, Hamill won't, and after next season, Lackey won't either. I believe that Adam Warren will eventually move into the rotation, but Kyle Hendricks is 26 years old and under contract, in arbitration. So he's going to be around. They have invested in this guy. They started him in two playoff games. He is a guy that they traded for and brought up and have really put a lot of effort into, you know, bringing him along. And just because of the style of pitcher he is doesn't mean we can just forget the fact that last season was his first full season in the big leagues. This season is his second full season in the big leagues. And even though the results have been there, the guy, you have to treat him just like every other kid in their first and second full season in the big leagues. The fact that he wore down a little bit at the end of the season might have a lot to do with the fact that he may not have ever tossed over 180 innings before or however many it was. So I think there's a lot of different nuanced things that we have to talk about, and we can't just say this is who Kyle Hendricks is. There, you can't just tell me that a 26-year-old starting pitcher, you know, isn't going to continue to work and get better.
Yeah, you know, I mean, you guys have both talked about Adam Warren quite a bit, and you've, you know, both expressed a lot of enthusiasm about him. He's struggled a little bit lately. He's given up homers the last two outings. Three of his last six outings, he's given up homers. His ERA over his last 10 games is over 3.86. So I'm just, there's maybe, I thought it was a great, you know, the losing Castro hurt a little bit, but getting Zobrist and him obviously was a huge plus for the Cubs. But, you know, Warren hasn't looked completely lights out like he did early on in the season. Are you guys feeling a little bit of hesitation about him? Or are you still as excited about him as you were a couple weeks ago?
No hesitation.
Whoa.
Yeah. All four of his home runs he's allowed this year have been to right field. And it's two left-handed hitters, two right-handed hitters who have hit them. I think he has just struggled at times hitting on the outside part of the of the plate, like he's leaving the ball up. So that's not something I'm ultimately that worried about. It wouldn't surprise me if that's coming as a result of him working with the pitching staff on something. I wrote extensively on him in the off season and looked at his stuff, and he has fantastic secondary stuff. He also, when I was at the Cubs convention, I got to interview him, and I know I've talked about this before, but one of the things he said that really stuck out to me was the Cubs told him when they acquired him that they acquired him to be a starter. They told him maybe not this year, but he was acquired specifically because they believe he is a starting pitcher. So that's why I say, you know, when anybody asks me about the rotation next year, I think it's pretty much a slam dunk that Adam Warren's in there. But, you know, you guys might feel differently about that just based on what you've seen, but I think he has a pretty good track record so far in the major leagues that he's a quality pitcher.
Well, to answer Joel's question, I don't really feel any different about Warren than I did a week ago. I'm going to throw out something ambiguous here. One of the home runs that he allowed was on a really good pitch. It was about 3 inches off the plate. It was a good breaking pitch low, and whoever was hitting just had an unbelievable at bat, and it was a hat tip type of moment. And I bookmarked it in my mind and thought, okay, that one's not on Warren. So that was one of the two. beyond that, I think, and I want to get your thoughts on this, Ryan, but I think next year's rotation for the Cubs might be identical to this year's. As long as Hamill doesn't trigger his mutual option, I think he has to get to 180 innings to make that a mutual option rather than just a Cubs option. So I can see next year still being the last year where Arrieta, Hamill, and Lackey are all still in the rotation. But then maybe in 2018, I can see Warren joining it as well. But with as successful as these five have been, I can certainly see them carrying that through for one. There's a lot of baseball to be played, but I can certainly see them playing that through for one more year.
Quick question on that. At this point, 2 months into the season, at the rate that he's going, if Hamill doesn't hit 180 innings pitched, I think we can fairly assume that he's had a bad second half. At that point, do you want the Cubs to pick up his option?
I actually don't think it's that cut and dry. He's got 54 innings right now. I definitely want them to pick up the option. It's only $10 million. He's well worth that, but I don't think he's going to hit, he's not even on pace right now to hit 180 innings. It's really close, but he's not there. It's actually something he's never done in his entire career. So somebody needs to fact check me. I'm sure one of our wonderful listeners will, on his option being 180 innings. It was only published in one article I could find. But yes, to answer your question, I do want them to pick it up. And I think there's a very good chance he doesn't hit that plateau. He had 170 last year. So if he doesn't, again, I think he comes back and is in the rotation for one more year.
He'd need to start on average, if he has 22 starts left, he needs to complete 5.7 innings per start. So he need to go an average of around 6 innings. So yeah, you're right. He may not hit there.
It's real close. It's really close. Your question is interesting. Obviously, I would hedge and say I'd like to wait and see what the rest of it is. But I mean, really, at $10 million, you can't get a whole lot of that in the open market for that. So I think it's pretty reasonable from the Cubs standpoint, even if he ends up being a bullpen arm or something. If your thesis kind of comes true and Warren ends up in the rotation, which I'm not against at all, I think that's a perfectly sound argument. But even if he ends up in the bullpen, I think his stuff could play pretty well in there.
Yeah, and I agree. Kind of moving it along here, I wanted to talk a little bit about Javier Baez and the hitting side. In May, Baez has really struggled at the plate, but I think that's a lot of BABIP kind of hurting him a little. He has really interesting numbers that I want to throw to both of you guys. His slash line, .217 batting average, .254 on base, .300 slugging. In 63 plate appearances, but
just in May.
Just in May,
yeah.
But only 9 strikeouts. That's a 14.3% strikeout percentage. This is the guy that we thought, if he only struck out 25% of the time, would be an all-star every year. So, what's your thought with going on with Javier Baez right now? Joel, what are you thinking about Baez and his struggles? And do you think it's something they're doing with him specifically, or do you think this is, you know, Baez making better contact but just, you know, having bad luck?
Well, his BABIP, I'm looking for that period, is under 200. So clearly he's got some bad luck going on. But I do feel like, you know, I mean, that's what entranced everyone, you know, the last couple of years, is that power. You know, that I go back to, you know, one of my favorite memories of the last, I mean, I don't know, 10 years, was that homer he hit in game four off, it was Lackey, I believe, right, against the Cardinals. So, you know, that kind of crazy power, that just unleashing that crazy swing. So part of me hates to see him lose that, but obviously his, you know, his K rate was unsustainable before. So obviously there, you know, and it's great. I just go back here a little bit. It's great that they have such a lead that they can be like, all right, you know what, Javier, we're going to really work with you. We're going to kind of put you in the lab and, you know, we're going to really work with you on this swing, and it doesn't matter. So don't sweat it, because we've got a big lead and we're obviously doing well. So it the pressure isn't really on him. So I guess on the one hand, you know, I've read, you know, on different message boards, people commenting saying that they're kind of giving up on him as a hitter.
That's absurd.
Yeah, that's clearly premature. But, you know, I think it's great that they obviously have the latitude to do that now, because the team is doing so well, and they can be like, you know what, don't sweat it. We're just going to work with you and try something new. And if you can, you know, I think that it's – players don't necessarily – improve on kind of a linear basis, and you can't say, we'll just kind of Frankenstein, you know, less strikeouts, and we'll, you know, make his swing a little more in control so he'll hit more line drives and less strikeouts. Like, it doesn't necessarily work like that. But at the same time, his K rate is crazy low. And if he can kind of, you know, incorporate that and a better eye into his, into who he is, you know, I am still pretty excited about him. And obviously, you know, his fielding and his base running, he hasn't played in a little bit, but, you know, I feel like most of the time when he plays, he does something really incredible, whether it's, you know, that play where he was, you know, he dove into first base. You know, we hate to see him do that because of, you know, he's had hand problems where he broke his thumb on a slide in a second, but he's just always doing something exciting, you know, in the field or on the base paths. So he's still a big question mark, but I'm still bullish on him.
I kind of have a theory with Baez this year, and that is that I think the front office and Joe Maddon are trying to elevate his floor. We know that his ceiling has been stratospheric for a long time, but I think what they're doing with Javier Baez is saying, okay, you can be a utility guy. You can move all around the diamond. You can do all of these things. You can bunt for base hits. You can make contact. We're going to make sure you can do all of these things before we say, okay, unleash the demon inside of you and try to be a superstar. So I think what they're doing is saying, take some time here. Take some time while you're not a regular, while we've got all these studs in front of you, and elevate your floor. Work on the finer points of your game and trying to become something you've never been before, which is a refined baseball player. He's becoming a refined baseball player. I like the idea, because they're telling Javier Baez, you're not going to bust. You will be a Major League Baseball player. And I like that. And I think that we are still at the tip of the iceberg of what he can do, because he has that in him, and we can see it. But if he can get to his floor, to a place where his foundation is solid, I am incredibly excited to see it. Just a few numbers that are interesting here. His O swing percentage is actually 5% higher this year. That's outside of the strike zone swings. It's actually 5% higher than it was in both 2014 and 2015. His Z swing percentage, which is the in-the-zone swings, is 3% higher than it was last year. His swing percentage in general this year is actually 4 points higher than it was last year, which I think are all surprising numbers. But when you combine that with his O contact percentage, it's 67.8%, which is actually quite high Last year it was 48%. So he's added 20 points and is outside of the zone swings, which is huge. His swinging strike percentage in general has gone from 19.2% in 2014 all the way down to 15% this year, which is actually relatively reasonable. So all of those things add up to a guy that is suddenly making contact. That, all of that to say that his strikeout rate coming down is legitimate. It's somewhat legitimate. I mean, there are some red flags here. His soft percentage contact is 21.1% this year, which is way up from last year. It was 7.5%. His medium contact is down, and obviously his hard contact is down as well. So he's not making as good of contact. One of the things that I'd like to see him do is go to the opposite field more. Last year he was 33%. This year he's 21%. So I think he's getting a little bit pole happy. Part of that's also, I think, probably the fact that he's been bunting more and he's been hitting the ball on the ground a little bit more. But I really believe their whole mantra is, okay, we're going to make sure Javier Baez doesn't bust because he's very valuable in the field and on the base paths. And then maybe later this year, maybe next year or the year after that, but then we can see him try and become a superstar.
Yeah, I'm just a little bit concerned, and this is nothing major, but at least for right now, the biggest strength that he's always had, the big thing we've always talked about, is that insane bat speed. And we saw it when he first came up in 2014, and we saw it a little bit last year. And, you know, sure, he would miss a ton, but when he would hit and when he would actually connect, the ball would go a long way. And I don't know if they've necessarily slowed him down at the plate, but I don't see that, like you just said, with the hard contact, I'm not seeing him, you know, really swinging and crushing the ball. I'm seeing him work on making better contact, which is great, but I do get concerned that they're trying to change him quite a bit fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And when I think about changing a hitter fundamentally at you know, kind of an advanced part of their development, I remember Starlin Castro, probably at right about the same age, them working with him and doing the same thing, and just how bad that looked for about a year and a half. Are you guys concerned with that, Joel? Do you have a big concern about that?
You know, it's funny you say that, Ryan, because I was thinking that exact thought a couple minutes ago. I was thinking that, you know, when, you know, Dale Swaim was working his magic as the manager, and you could tell what they were trying to do with Castro. Was trying to make him think more and get him to walk more and maybe boost his OBP. But and you know, he's who he is. He's a guy who swings at pitches all over the place and makes contact, and he's doing pretty well for the Yankees, and I feel like it's now everyone knows who he is. And I think that's a good point with Baez. It's like, I mean, you kind of, you know, his bat speed is kind of his, I don't know, his magic bullet, you know, the ace up his sleeve. And I don't know that you can make him into, you know, Chris Bryant, who will sit there and take pitches and foul pitches off and see a bunch of pitches. I think that I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know that he's amazing in the field. He's great on the base paths, and he's got a lot of potential at the plate. But I guess I do wonder if maybe they are trying to fiddle with him a little too much. I am optimistic that they will figure it out, but I think that's a good point, Ryan, that his bat speed is kind of his, you know, magic talisman, and you don't want to mess with it too much. So what do you think about that, Isaac?
It's an interesting comparison to Castro, for sure. I think that the difference that you've got is Starlin Castro was never going to bust, but they were trying to get him to become something that he wasn't, but the problem was is he'd already established himself as a valuable major league player without being that. So I look back at the decision to try and really fundamentally change Castro, and I go, what exactly were you going to gain? I mean, was a 200 hit but maybe doesn't take enough walks or hit enough home runs guy not good enough? I mean, was Starlin Castro the guy? Did he have the psyche to think, he's going to, I shouldn't even go here because of how overplayed this was, but is he going to be the guy that is going to work hard enough to actually make changes at the major league level to become something that he's fundamentally not? I don't think he was that guy, and that is not a shot at Starlin Castro at all, not at all. I think Javier Baez can be that guy. From everything I've heard about him, and his work ethic and how badly he wants it, from tattooing the MLB logo on his neck to just the interviews I've heard of him and the fiery competitor that he is. I think he does want it. So I share your concern about making him too much of a horse from the unicorn that he is, but I think that they were supremely worried about his bust factor, as we all were. I think they said, this guy might bust, and we're not willing to let that happen. Let's make sure he does not bust and make him a big league player, and then we'll see if the one step that we're taking backward can actually vault him two steps forward in the future.
That's all really good points on Baez, and really, when I talk about concerns, it's a minor concern. It's more just a thought in the back of my mind that I think it's worth taking it out there and really discussing it. So I think maybe we should talk a little bit about how he affects the lineup in concern to Jorge Soler and Tommy La Stella, who I think at this point it's fair to say those three are pretty much sharing one spot. And even Matt Caesar is getting in occasionally. He started today. So I want to know what you guys have to think about the playing time and the way it's been split up. Joel, you mentioned that Baez hadn't played a lot recently. Tommy La Stella has started two games in the last 2 weeks. So do you think with Jorge Soler kind of coming on lately, do you think the playing time is becoming an issue where, you know, maybe La Stella and Baez are struggling a little bit at the plate just because they're not in there regularly?
Well, there are so many. We've all looked at, Madden as this mystical sorcerer who can kind of make everything happen, and God bless him. I love the guy, but there are only so many positions, and there are several players who are going to play every day. Obviously, Rizzo, Bryant, Russell, Hayward, Fowler. So there's only so many variables that you can work with there. So Soler has been coming around, and I think we're excited about that. I know we've discussed him several times over the past couple weeks. I feel like La Stella, I don't know, what's his ceiling? Like, is he a starter? I don't really see that. So I think his ceiling is really, great pinch hitter utility guy. I'm comfortable with that. But as far as Baez, I think that he's, and I think that maybe the reason Soler has improved the last couple of weeks has been, it's warmed up, and I hate to just go with, well, he doesn't play as well when it's cold, but the numbers seem to bear that out. But so there's that. But I also think that, Madden has shown some trust in him, and I think that's benefited him. I don't know what you do with Baez as far as playing time, because who are you going to sit? Russell, Isaac, I feel like you're going to jump through my computer screen and punch me, but, he hasn't been.
I would love to.
He hasn't exactly been, killing it the past couple weeks. So you could, I wouldn't mind seeing him get a day off just to kind of get his stuff together and go through the thousands of fan letters that you've sent him. Maybe that's part of the problem. Do you think that's maybe it? It's freaking him out a little bit.
You think my fawning is just overwhelming, overbearing?
I'm just wondering. I'm just throwing it out there as one theory.
Look, you don't know how many letters I've gotten back, all right? So just lay off.
Okay, all right. It's your own business there.
Correct me if I'm wrong. He got a day off like 2 or 3 days ago, didn't he? Same day as Rizzo did? Am I wrong?
He was dreaming? There, I think. Yeah. Man,
could have sworn
Rizzo,
he got
Rizzo
one.
Rizzo and Hayward.
Hayward, thanks. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Ryan, where do you put Baez? Let's just kind of go with the theory that, they want him to develop, and they're going to work with him, and they're going to try to modulate his swing a little bit, which is, all makes sense, and I think you and I are kind of on the same page that you want to see him bring it down a little bit, but at the same time, you don't want that to come at the expense of the bat speed. So, it's funny, we're talking about this as if it's like an algebra problem. You can kind of, or geometry or something. I wasn't very good at math, but you can move these things around and, boost this variable and lower this variable. But, these are human beings, and he kind of is who he is. So I don't know. I kind of get back to your point about Starlin Kasser. Like you kind of don't want to mess with the raw material that's there. But the point is, like, if they do see him as a valuable piece going forward, where do they play him? Because he'd obviously benefit from that. So, you know, who sits? And I don't know where that happens.
If you're talking how do they get him in next year and beyond, that's a really great question. I don't know how to answer that at this point. I think there's a reason that they've taught him the outfield, and I think that's not something that they just decided they were going to do for this year and see what happens. I think there's a chance that they put him in the outfield going forward after this, you know, not exclusively, but just, you know, maybe working him in more frequently next year and after that. But yeah, as a general question on Baez, I don't know if it's fair to say that he's a part-time player for the next several years. I don't think that's fair to him and his potential. So if he's not traded somewhere else for in a major move, yeah, I do wonder how do they get him into the lineup every day? Because he deserves to be an everyday player just as much as, you know, probably Addison Russell deserves to be an everyday player, or Ben Zobrist deserves to be an everyday player. So I don't know. I don't think we're ready to answer where that goes yet, but I do think that they're going to have to – something will have to change.
I just think that we're not used to having a team that we follow so closely be this deep, because I remember – some of the Yankees and Braves teams from the 90s and early 2000s that you always felt like they had a guy on the bench that should be starting. Javi Lopez maybe was there for a while, and there was a couple of guys on the Yankees. Their names are escaping me right now, but there was always guys that you thought, man, if you could just see them in a 150-game sample, they'd hit 25 home runs, or, you know, they'd hit 290. And Baez is one of those guys that you always feel like could play more, and I still think we're sleeping on Tommy La Stella's bat a little bit, because, Joel, I think you called him a nice pinch hitter or something like that. The guy walks as much as he strikes out in the major leagues, which is extremely rare. He's hitting the ball on a line with regularity this year. Tommy La Stella is actually a guy that I think a lot of teams would salivate to have starting at second base for them. I really do. I think he's a really good hitter. But you know what? Hat tip to Jorge Soler. He looks like a different player at the plate this week. And I'll talk about him a little bit more later. There's your official tease. But, guys, this is a great problem to have.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
that's the mark of a really good team. Can you imagine if Kyle Schwarber is starting left fielder?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that.
Then you'd have all three of them and no spot for them. That would be your bench along with David Ross. That would be your bench. So it's a wonderful problem to have, and I hope we have to continue talking about it all year long.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to spend too much time about La Stella. I mean, I agree. I mean, the guy is a professional hitter. There's no doubt about that. I mean, Soler, obviously the past couple weeks has turned it on, but, I mean, I don't have a lot of confidence that he's going to, you know, get a hit, or he's just as likely to get a hit or hit a homer or strike out in my eyes. Every time La Stella's up, I'm like, he's going to work it and likely, you know, get at least a single, maybe a double. I just feel very confident with him. But at the same time, I think we saw a couple, you know, a week or two ago, he made, what, two errors at third base. Like, I just think that his glove, I think his ceiling as a overall player is high-ish, but not super high, whereas someone like Baez, you know, is higher. So I just don't see where you put him, just kind of on a logistical level. That's my point about La Stella.
Is he the Kyle Hendricks of the offense, though? I mean, he's one of those guys that was too small and didn't have enough power, and yeah, he could do it in the minors, but big league pitching is going to expose him, all of these different things, and yet here he is. He's still hitting the same line drives he did in the minors. He's still taking the walks. He's still not striking out. He's still getting on base. I concede your point about the glove. It's below average. But he's like a guy that scouts hate and just gets on. He just gets on. He scores. He gets on base, for lack of any, you know, eloquence. But I feel like he's one of those guys that might be criminally underrated until he gets a starting gig somewhere and plays every day, and then suddenly you're looking at a guy that's, you know, compiled a 370 on base or something like that and had a really nice season. So anyway, like you said, we don't have to spend too much time on it, but I'm in the LaStella fan club.
I like LaStella a little bit too, and I do think he's kind of the Kyle Hendricks of the offense, mostly in that he starts every fifth day.
Oh, snap!
Brutal. All right, going to our last topic before we go to the segments. Jason Hayward, I've been really drumming up on Twitter about the fact that he, even when people think, oh, he's coming out of it because he gets a couple hits in a row and then he continues to struggle, he's hitting the ball on the ground like crazy. He hit a double against the Cardinals the other day where everyone kind of oohed and aahed because it was a big hit, but it was a fastball over the inside, upper inside portion of the plate, and he swung, and when he hit it, it went straight down into the ground and then hit the bag over at first base into the right field corner. That said, the last couple of days, he's hit the ball in the air more frequently against the Phillies, three of them coming out as doubles. So he hit three doubles in the series, and I think just in general at the plate has looked so much better. Interesting fact about those three doubles, though, that means that 33% of the doubles or extra base hits total, 33% of the extra base hits he's hit this season were hit in those three games against the Phillies.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, I've been I find him pretty frustrating, and I know that I'm channeling my inner meatball here, and I know that the analytics crowd loves him for his on-base percentage and his base running and his defense, and that all is great.
What crowd, Joel? Be honest. Yeah, don't censor yourself.
Nerd crowd? Is that where you're going? I'm not sure where you're going there.
Where do those nerds make
their... Oh, they're in their mother's basement.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry. You're right. You know, don't go halfway. You're right. Go all the way.
Okay. Sorry.
They're eating Cheetos in their mother's basement, and they're like, oh, his UZR, if you look at it.
But, I'm literally in my mom's basement right now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, no judgment. We've all been there.
And I'm eating Cheetos.
In your mother's... We've all been in your mother's basement. if you know what I mean.
Great old gal.
So, I mean, yeah, and I feel like I've heard this a lot on different podcasts, and, you know, it's like there's this kind of, like, patronizing sniff, like, well, those people who don't like Jason Hayward don't realize what he brings the team on the base paths in the field. And, you know, okay, fine, great. That's, I get that. I get that. He's a great fielder, you know, and he makes great plays. I also see a corner outfielder who has one home run and has hit, what, how many extra base hits this year? Seven?
Nine.
You know, nine. I find that frustrating, and I'm sorry. I mean, maybe they're working with him. You know, maybe he's going to turn it on. He did go the opposite way for a double, within the last couple of games. That's very exciting. I'm just starting to run out of patience a little bit, and I know he's looked better, but, I mean, my God, you know, look, I know they're winning without him, and you know, you can't complain about this team, and he plays great defense and blah, blah, blah. But I see a guy who's I see a corner outfielder hitting, Darwin Barney is on par with those numbers, and it really bothers me. I pull that out every time just to make you mad, Isaac, just so you know, by the way.
Actually,
it Darwin works every Barney. Time.
Yeah, Darwin Barney's actually better this year, if you want to be completely true about it. Barney is, I want to say, hitting over 300 with like a 360 on base or something like that.
What?
Yeah. I haven't totaled it all up, but it's actually maddeningly frustrating how good Darwin Barney has been with the bat since he left the Cubs. I want to say, and it's not like he's played full seasons or anything, but in a part-time role with the Dodgers and the Blue Jays, he has like a 780 OPS since he left the Cubs.
I mean, look, I don't know. I feel like I said what I need to say, and I'm gonna get all sorts of angry, you know, emails. Well, do you know what his blah blah? You know, like, okay, look, I get it.
Wait. Are these people not like 19-year-old millennials in their mother's basement, but they're actually 80-year-old get off my lawn folks? What was that voice?
You know, they're too busy. They've got their mouth full of Cheetos, and they're, you know, smoking weed. Don't all millennials smoke weed? Isn't that, you know?
I have never tried weed, and I am a millennial.
Wow.
Don't lie. I'm a millennial. I'm not so, free.
Ryan's pulling up the average there, so it's all good. Yeah. It's more than averages out, I'm sure.
Yeah, but it does.
Go for it.
Darwin Barney, and I can't total it just from when he left the Cubs, but with the Cubs, 244 average, 290 on base, 335 slugging, a 625 OPS. With the Dodgers in parts of two seasons, 270 average, 429 on base.
Wow.
378 slugging for an 807 OPS.
Tell the whole story. How many? You know how many at bats he has with the Dodgers total? Had
69.
37.
All right, come on. All right, then in 99 at-bats in parts of 2 years with the Blue Jays, 313 average, 346 on base, 495 slugging. It's completely true. He has an over 800 OPS since he left the Cubs. It's in like 136 at-bats, but still.
Yeah, I think he stole Russell Martin's soul and took all of his offensive skill with it.
So maybe Jason Hayward is like a Jackson Pollock painting, and the critics are saying like, "Ugh, you just don't get it, you plebeians." But like, I'm looking at him and I'm seeing like, God damn it, hit the ball in the outfield. Like, you're 6'5". Don't, my God, like, please, like, Ryan Terrio is, you know, hit more homers than this guy. Like, it's just really frustrating, and I'm sorry, I know he plays great defense, he's got a great arm, wah, wah, wah. You know, I acknowledge all of that, but I don't want that. I want a corner outfielder who's going to make the defenses a little nervous, and not because he's going to hit a screaming grounder past a second baseman.
I just love the fact that we have, like, the ultimate dichotomy between Hayward, who, you know, touches his elbows together before he swings and can't get the ball out of the infield and makes Joel terribly mad. And then we have Soler, who, you know, a few games this week notwithstanding, is pretty wretched in the outfield, but just hits the ball a mile when he actually hits it. So those two are just polar opposites of each other. And to be honest, there's this masochistic part of myself that wants Hayward to continue sucking all year so Joel can just see quietly in his attic.
Not so quietly.
You know, is that the opposite of being in your mom's basement is sitting in your attic?
You guys have to picture this. Joel is literally sitting in his attic of his house as he talks
it's
about.
It's like 95 degrees up in this beat, by the way.
Maybe you should take something from the nerd sitting in the 65 degree basement. You know, while you sweat.
So all right. So just to create the image, Isaac and I are in our mother's basements, with our Excel spreadsheets, and Joel is like counting on an abacus
in his attic.
And Ryan's got like a bong next to him, and Isaac's got the Bible. Don't discuss the devil's weed. How dare you 420 heathens.
I thought we were making jokes.
And where's Carlos again? Somewhere down south?
I'm not going to touch that one.
I thought we were making jokes. You just said that I'm here with a bong. What's the joke?
Rolling fatties.
Nope. No judgment here. No judgment.
All right. We'll get you one. We'll get you one day, Isaac.
Yeah, we will. We will indeed.
All right.
All right. So, Joel, you have an I wonder for us, and it's not I wonder. What strain of marijuana Ryan's smoking currently? What's your I wonder?
I actually do wonder that, but that's not what this segment is. We can discuss that later.
Mine's called Bernie Sanders' Dank Stash. Go on.
Nice. I wonder what the Cubs outfield will be next year.
Ooh, that's a good question.
Did we talk about that last week, or was that off air?
I think we talked we did. we talked 2 weeks ago where we kind of led into this a little bit.
And oh.
And then actually, Clarissa on our site, on BP Wrigleyville, she engaged me privately about that and thought that was a really interesting topic. And then last week we forgot to go on it again. So that's good on Joel for bringing that up.
Yeah, you did something right. Good job.
About time.
For once.
So, Isaac, this goes to you. Put down 1 Corinthians and answer. What do you think? Who is the outfield next year?
13. It's all about love, and I love you, Joel. I think probably starting in left will be Darwin Barney. I think Terrio can put his outfielder glove on and play center. So, and then I'm keeping Hayward in right.
Doug DeCenzo in right. I'll have a higher slugging percentage than Jason Hayward.
Oh, man. Okay. In all seriousness, this is a phenomenal question, and it is something that I poked Albert Almora on when I interviewed him a couple of weeks ago. I said, hey, what do you have to do to be the starting center fielder next year? And he gave me a little sly smile and look, and then gave me the company line, which was, I can't control that. They're going to do what they want to do. I got to do everything I can here. But I could tell that deep down that's where his goal is. It's I want to be in center field next year in Wrigley Field. So, you know what? I'm going to go for it. I think it's going to be Hayward in right. I think it's going to be Kyle Schwarber and Jorge Soler in left. And I think Albert Almora is going to get a glut of starts in center field. I think the only way that Dexter Fowler comes back is if they work out some crazy one-year deal or maybe a longer-term extension. But I think he's probably gone with the qualifying offer. And I think Almora is the replacement there. As kind of crazy as that is, you may see Hayward there with Soler and Schwarber flanking him on both sides at times, but I think you'll see him.
Well, that's really interesting because this is the problem with improving part of our finish of the show is my question of the week that I'm reading is basically this topic. And I'll go ahead and run into it, and we can just continue because we're already talking about it. But the question is from someone who describes themselves as Joel's cutting room floor. Would you extend Dexter Fowler if you could get a number 3 starting pitcher for Jorge Soler plus filler?
Yeah, I've been on that train since the beginning of time. I mean, I like Jorge Soler. I love his potential. I like his bat. But, man, if you get a number 3 for him, I was throwing out Julio Teheran for quite some time now, which doesn't look so crazy anymore, does it, haters? yes, I would be interested in extending Fowler, depending on the cost, of course, as everything. But, that also depends on Almora. That depends on Almora and what they think he is, if they think he's a major league starter or not. I personally think that he is. So, but, yeah, to answer your question, absolutely.
Yeah, I'd do that in a heartbeat. I mean, and I'm fairly bullish on Soler. I think he's got a – obviously his defense is lacking at best, but I feel like he will come around, and I feel like he's got a pretty high ceiling offensively. But I trade him in a heartbeat. And because I just feel like you've got enough coming up, you've got Schwarber, who I trust so much more at the plate. And defensively, I don't feel like there's much of a drop-off there. And you've got a bunch of guys coming up in the minors. I know there are some years off, but Eloy Jimenez, obviously, comes to mind. Soler, I help him pack his bags for that trade.
All right, and this, I don't know if it was implied in the question, but it wasn't written in there, but I'll imply it. You trade Soler plus filler for a number 3. So you've got the return of Kyle Schwarber in left. Center field is a long-term Dexter Fowler, and right field is at least 2 more seasons of Jason Hayward. What about Almora? Where is he traded? Is he part-time player for 2 years? What are you doing with him? I mean, that outfield right there is locked up at least 2 years.
Yeah, that's a good question.
Well, for one, he would probably replace Schwarber defensively every game. So an outfield of Fowler, Almora, and Hayward, whichever way you want to shake it, is extremely good, and that would be very, very fun to watch late in games. So you've got a defensive lockdown, so he'd get a lot of time on the field. Two, I think he would probably spell one of those three guys pretty occasionally because you've got a couple of left. All three of them are lefty on certain days, but you've got lefties in there that you know, traditionally can struggle a little bit with lefties. So I think whenever you saw a lefty in the game, he'd probably be starting. So at least in the first 2 years, I think Almora would get plenty of playing time as the fourth outfielder, and I think that's fine. Letting him adjust to it, letting him play defense, letting him start against left-handers. I don't think there's any problem with that. So I actually kind of like that, to be honest.
Hmm.
Well, then I think that answers everything I wanted to know about that. That's a good question.
I do feel like we maybe within the next couple of weeks we pick this up because I feel like this is a good – there's a lot more grist for this mill, you know, but
– Yeah. So. Yeah, I think that that's a really interesting topic that we're going to be able to continue talking about going forward, just from, you know, the fact that they have been so crowded in the outfield and that they have Elmora coming, they have Schwarber coming back, they have Fowler on a one-year deal. We think there's no chance he's back next year, but that's also how we felt about it, you know, literally 4 months ago right now. I guess let's just go to Joel. Do you have a 60 seconds with a former Cub?
I do indeed. And I've heard suggestions for players who are more contemporary. But, you know, I've heard his name come up actually recently just kind of serendipitously a couple times in the last couple weeks. So when you can talk about Larry Bittner, you really have to take that opportunity.
Absolutely, and I've been fielding requests. I'm sure you have. Then, I've had people suggest Mark Bellhorn and Brian LaHare.
Yeah,
I figured Joel could do all kinds of amazing things with LaHare.
Oh my word!
Yeah,
close cousin of LeCocq.
Yeah, since you have no LaHare.
Oh, wait.
Ouch! Painful.
All right, are you ready?
I'm ready.
I'm starting the clock, and go.
There may be no I in team, but there are two I's in Bittner, and two T's, actually. That doesn't add up to a stud player, but does add up to one of the most sadly memorable plays in Cub history. But let's back up a moment. Larry Bittner came to the Cubs in a trade for future All-Star Andre Thornton, because, hey, anytime you can give up a future All-Star who would go on to hit more than 200 homers, you have to get rid of that dead weight. But Bittner, a ramshackle jalopy of a player who always seemed to look like he was 57 years old, had a fairly notable time with the Cubs, and it was specifically for one play. On September 26, 1979, Bittner went rumbling, stumbling, bubbling for a ball hit to the right field and missed it, and it ended up under his hat. He couldn't find it, and meanwhile the bleacher bums were shouting, "Hat, hat," and runner Bruce Boisclair paused around second.
10 seconds.
Which enabled Bittner to find the ball and, incredibly, throw Boisclair out at third. So in the correct version of this play, Boisclair would have scored, but that's Larry Bittner always throwing off the narrative.
1 minute. Good job, Joel.
Thank you.
Larry Bittner, forgettable Cub.
Yes. And yeah, yet unforgettable, too.
I thought you were, when you started talking about one of the most dubious plays in Cubs history, I was thinking you're going to refer to it as Bittner's boner. Like Merkel's boner?
Yeah, I get it.
I'm sure most listeners have no idea what that play is. But
yeah,
that is also
I feel like I've used up all my penile references with the Pete LeConnick 60 seconds thing a couple weeks ago, so I'm just going to let that one...
Wait. Those were penis references? Wow, I wondered why everyone was laughing.
Yeah. Huh. Ryan can explain it to you.
You're doing a good job playing straight man since Carlos isn't here.
Thank you.
All right. Well, Isaac, do you have a plate appearance of the week or a hit by pitch of the week or sack fly of the week for us?
I do. See, this is the thing. You know, exit velocity is wonderful and everything else, but when all I can do is talk to you about it, there's nothing really to visualize. So a walk is as good as a hit, truly, in this instance. But this week, I am actually going to talk about something with some legitimate exit velocity. That comes from the veritable Jorge Soler on Friday against the Phillies. The Cubs entered the fourth inning tied 1-1. Soler actually owned the RBI single in the first inning that put the Cubs ahead 1-0, but the Phillies tied it in the third inning. Come the fourth inning, Soler came up with nobody out, led off the inning. He took a ball and then took a strike and swung and missed at a fastball, three straight fastballs from Phillies starter Adam Morgan. The fourth pitch, which is what for me makes it memorable, was a slider. And it was a pretty good slider. It was on the inside half of the plate, which is where the catcher sat up. He was asking for it. It hung just slightly, but it got to the corner of the plate, and Soler just whipped it back around and hit it about 455 feet off the scoreboard. Exit velocity of 108 miles per hour plus, launch angle of 30 degrees. It was interesting because the pitch before that, the one that he took for a strike, was about 3 or 4 inches off the plate, which has seemingly happened to him just dozens of times this year. It's just a huge strike zone against. Three straight fastballs. He then turned around the slider, hit it off the scoreboard, which was, I think, a really big moment for Soler's season and just for the fans in general watching him struggle and seeing him turn that slider around. So Jorge Soler goes ahead 2-1 on Friday's game against the Phillies. That is your at-bat of the week.
Nice.
Yeah, that is one of the more memorable ones of the week, I think.
I guess that at bat kind of showed why people are, you know, are so optimistic about him and still hold out such hope for him. And, you know, I mean, I feel justifiably so.
Yeah, it was more than anything, it was relieving. And it was like a big exhalation I could feel from everyone, where it was just even Soler, where it felt like a little bit of a burden off of his shoulders or something of that nature. You can't put too much into one swing, but the fact that it was a breaking pitch after three straight fastballs, the fact that it was kind of on the black, it was right there, and it broke open a tie game, and all of these different things, and you just kind of went, oh, man, maybe he's going to put it together now.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of hope for Soler putting it together now, and I think that those who are patient are being rewarded, and I think there was nobody more patient with him than the Cubs front office and Joe Maddon this year, basically saying, we know he's not playing a whole lot right now, but we're going to need him to play a big role. And idiots like me were saying, if you're not going to play him, send him down, let him work on his issues. I stand by what I said. I think he could have been back in June if they had sent him down, you know, at the beginning of May when he was really scuffling and not playing at all. I think he could have been back in June and hitting and playing every day, but that's neither here nor there. The important thing is that they're getting production out of him, and hopefully he keeps it up the rest of the year.
Yeah, and we've been pretty tough on him. You have, and I have, and I don't think it was unfair. The fact of the matter is he's had a decent week. He still struggled. He's a corner outfielder, and to Joel's earlier point, Hayward is struggling, but he brings a lot in other facets of the game. I just put on very thick glasses when I said that, Joel.
Yeah, do your pocket protector there. It looks great.
So Lair has to hit, which we've covered many times. He has to. So I also stand by what you had been saying about him. I think it was a perfectly viable opinion, and as much as I hate agreeing with you. But on the other hand, we've been hard on him, and it is really nice to see him put together some good at-bats.
You said hard on.
You did. Your mom's not going to like that.
We digress.
She's going to yell at you from the top of the stairs. I heard that.
Keep it down there. All right. Well, do you guys have anything else to add? We're looking forward a little bit to the schedule. The Cubs start 4 with the Dodgers, and they're going to miss Clayton Kershaw because he's pitching today. So that couldn't set up any better. So things are looking good, continuing their run of success into this week. Anything to add to that?
Not really. It's bittersweet because I love to watch Kershaw pitch, but on the other hand, man, I'll take it. I'll take missing him in the turn, and hopefully we can watch some more winning baseball this week.
Yeah, so I'll be there Tuesday night. So looking forward to it.
You get the classic Arrieta Scott Kazmir matchup.
Mm.
Oh, it's so sultry.
Gonna finally come out of your attic then.
Oh boy, we're leaving that alone.
We'll see.
All right. Well, for all you listeners, you can follow us and all of our brilliance on Twitter at BP WrigleyCast. I'm at Ryan Davis BP. These guys are whatever they are. At Isaac C. Bennett, at Joel C. Reese. Carlos is at Carlos Porto. You can email us bpwrigleycast@baseballprospectus.com. Don't be shy about sending your questions of the week. It's like pulling teeth, getting you jerks to talk to us. I know we see the numbers. You people are listening, so you know, reach out, leave reviews, you know, tweet us, email us, whatever you want to do. Tell us how much we suck, whatever you want to do.
We know.
Yeah, we already know, but feel free to tell us anyway. We look forward to having Carlos back from his pottery class next week. Hopefully Fight Club won't get in the way, and we'll be back at full strength. So with that, good night, guys. Thanks for helping me lead.
Take care.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Good night.